We are extremely sad to inform our listeners that on Tuesday the 27th of April, we learned the shocking and devastating news that renowned conservationist Rory Young had been killed by terrorists whilst leading a wildlife protection patrol in Burkina Faso. Two Spanish journalists who were documenting Rory's efforts to protect wildlife were also killed in the ambush. Many of the topics we cover on this podcast often fill us with sadness, anger and despair about the degradation of our natural world, communities and wild animals. Despite this, we always try and balance an element of hope and optimism when talking to our exceptional guests about their lives and experiences. With this in mind, when we released Rory's episode last week, David and I had no doubt that his extraordinary, hard-hitting experiences and insight into wildlife protection would make an indelible impact on everyone who listened. David and I send our deepest condolences to Rory's family and friends and the families of those who died, as well as the Chingeta Wildlife Team. We hope that this podcast can contribute in some small way to preserving the memory of a man that dedicated his life to wildlife protection and to finding long-term workable solutions to preserve our planet's wild areas.
Hey everyone, it's Dave here. There hasn't been a coup here at Pod Headquarters, but our guest today certainly knows a few things of what it's like to work and operate in some of the most politically unstable environments going. It's a pleasure to welcome Rory Young from Chingeta Wildlife onto the pod. As a co-founder and president of Chingeta Wildlife, we'll be learning how Rory has dedicated his life to wildlife protection and how Chingeta seeks to tackle poaching as a whole from every angle. With that said, welcome to the pod, Rory.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's warm up with an introduction. For our listeners who haven't come across Chingeta, what do they need to know?
We are an organization that is focused on delivering support in the form of knowledge, skills, solutions, techniques to the most challenging environments and most difficult missions for wildlife law enforcement and for the communities living in those areas. So our mission, in short, is protect the wildlife areas and the people who depend on them, and do so by providing support to those who have the mandate to protect the wildlife and support the communities.
And I think that's really interesting, because there's loads of groups out there who'll go out there and lead the charge, so to speak, but you're very much there to support the existing infrastructure and teams on the ground, I suppose.
Yes, exactly. So it doesn't mean we're not on the front line. I mean, we're literally in the thick of it with those who are having the most difficult time and trying to produce the results. But it means we don't command direct control. We only capacity build, even if that means standing on the front line while the bullets are flying, saying, "We suggest you do this, duck," so on.
Yes. So you have some key fundamental pillars to your approach in these areas. So as far as I understand, it's anti-poaching and counter-trafficking. You have sociocultural research and engagement, and then you have your investigations, analytical support and community liaison.
Yes, absolutely. So we go through a process of, first of all, analyzing. Generally, it's analyzing a situation, the challenges, the threats, the resources available, the structures, the mandates, the laws in place, and truly understanding what's going on and how can we really help. And often that just boils down to asking a community, why are you poaching? Or do you want to do this? Or are you doing it out of necessity? Or are you being forced to do it? I mean, there's so many different factors that can influence or generate illegal activity. So first of all, we analyze, then we engage. We engage with government, NGOs, international organizations, especially community and the Rangers on the ground to understand all the perspectives, all the, again, challenges, motivations, needs, and then we then take it to the next stage, which is we harmonize. So before we can start training and mentoring people, which is usually the ultimate goal, or in the case of communities, providing support for education or solutions to generators of poaching. But before we can do that, we harmonize our activities with all the stakeholders. So we're not going to go along and start reinventing the wheel, doing something that's already being done. We're not going to start suggesting very expensive solutions. You know, you need a helicopter and you need, you know, satellites and drones and all the rest of it, when there is a very pragmatic, cost-effective local solution available. But then we get to the training and the mentoring. And to do that, you can teach or mentor someone in anything. It has to be pertinent. So we develop doctrine, obviously not doctrine as in the tactics, techniques, procedures, the strategies, the knowledge and skills that an entire local force or unit will need. We develop that with them, and we then provide the training in that doctrine. And then, of course, after a period of mentoring in the field with the rangers and working with the communities, we go through the full cycle again of, right, now we need to revisit, analyze what we've done, has it worked or not, what are the problems, how can it be improved, and we start the process again. So we go through the full cycle again.
Brilliant. And if we take a step back from the specifics, which we'll go into in further detail later on, can you tell us where you're operating in what sort of environments?
Yes, we are in the Sahel and the Congo Basin, mostly, specifically in Mali, in the Gourma region, which is central Mali, in the middle of the conflict area, and in Burkina Faso, can't reveal the actual location because we're rolling out operations here now, in Central African Republic, in Zanga-Sanga, which is part of the Sanga protected areas, and then in Democratic Republic of Congo. I can't, again, mention that just yet. And also Cameroon, Congo-Brazzaville, and we're looking into rolling out support in several other countries in the Horn of Africa and elsewhere in the Sahel and West Africa.
So I suppose a wider theme to these areas are, by and large, they mostly be termed conflict areas?
I think all of the areas we're operating in are countries in conflict, although the areas we're in at a given time may not necessarily be in conflict. So, for example, Mali, it's definitely right smack bang. We're working in the middle of the ongoing religious, political, and ethnic conflict. In Central African Republic, on the other hand, CAR is at war, is a conflict environment. But Zanga-Sanga specifically, it currently is not. It's very peaceful. It's a safe haven within a far more serious situation. And it's on the border with Cameroon and Congo Brazzaville, and quite distanced from all the fighting.
And in these areas, there must be a level of corruption that you face, or?
There is, absolutely. It varies greatly from place to place and department to department and individual to individual. Okay. I've come across corruption in international organizations, which would surprise most people. And I've come across incredible honesty in environments where you would not expect any sort of sincere, reliable behavior from people.
And in the world of conservation, we often hear about corruption. But for those up there who are fortunate enough never to have come across corruption, what does it look like, or how does it appear, and how do you navigate it in some of these areas you work in?
I'll be shoot dead straight. I mean, we've dealt with soldiers, rangers that we're working with selling ammunition. And we've dealt with rangers poaching. And of course, for poachers, or traffickers rather, to get their product out of country to the destination market, there usually has to be some level of complicity on the part of government officials. In some cases, we found ourselves in situations where we know there is high-level government involvement in, and I'm not going to give a specific place or country, in trafficking. And we know that that trafficking, in turn, supports violent extremist groups. Very often, it's so blurred and so complex, you can't distinguish one criminal network or group or activity from another. So the convergence of activities, in other words, let's look at Central African Republic, where we work. There's tramadol, so drugs, ammunition moving into the area. There's ivory and pangolin scales especially moving out of the area. And then there's an enormous amount of diamonds illegally trafficked just north of the park. The diamonds themselves, the trafficking of diamonds, means large amounts of cash into criminal hands. And inevitably, that's going to expand into other forms of interest, of power. So politics or, criminal groups often evolve into political or armed groups and vice versa. So corruption is an enormous problem. And I would say beyond corruption, the most important thing is governance in many of these environments. Rule of law, peace and security, that's what's missing. That's what enables these situations to develop. So for example, in Mali, until 2012, our partners, Wild Foundation, were very successfully working with the communities in the Gourma region to protect elephant habitat, deal with or avoid human-wildlife conflict and other problems that inevitably affected the elephant population and the communities living in the elephant range. But in 2012, when the rebellion took place and the subsequent war and violent extremist takeover, suddenly the real problems arose with poachers and traffickers deliberately targeting the elephant. I mean, one year, 25% of the population of elephants was wiped out. And these sort of people are opportunists. And it doesn't, in some cases, they've moved into the area, fighters that moved in from wherever, Libya and other places, and subsequently now Syria as far away as Afghanistan and so on. But in some cases, they are local people who behave themselves when there is a good governance, rule of law. And when that situation deteriorates, they either through, because of opportunity, they have certain criminal tendencies already, or because of desperation, they become enabled and start poaching or trafficking. All of those people will do drugs, ivory, weapons, explosives, as opportunity arises. And that's the problem. So that mix of poverty, desperation, war, displacement, as well as greed, all mixed up, creates a extremely challenging environment to work in and an extremely challenging problem to solve.
Yeah, I can't imagine. But part of what we want to hear about here on the podcast is about you and the individuals who work for these amazing organizations or found these amazing organizations. And we want to celebrate that. So before we go on to talk about Mali, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, Rory, and how you got into this industry?
Sure. My passion is wildlife and as well as wild areas, the people who live in those areas. And I tried once going into the military, jumped out of some airplanes, they gave me a badge, blah, blah, blah. It did not work for me. I hated being told what to do. I went into the bush professionally because I'd loved it throughout my childhood, growing up in Zambia, Zimbabwe, Malawi. And I started out becoming a professional guide in Zimbabwe at a time when it was a very tough four-year apprenticeship. And I found I really enjoyed one of my first jobs, which was relocating cheetah into the Matusadona National Park. My job was to build the boma and look after the cheetahs and so on. And the next job, which was not guiding at all, but but what was termed in those days problem animal control, human wildlife conflict in the Omei area. And I would spend usually 2 months at a time with a Land Rover and a rifle. And my job was to make sure that animals, dangerous animals, weren't hurting people, people weren't hurting the animals, and that crops weren't being destroyed. Unfortunately, in those days, often the solution, the order was go and put that animal down, usually because it was had a broken leg or a bullet from a poacher in its face, whatever. But it was a real learning curve for me, understanding what it means for a large family living hand-to-mouth existence to lose their entire food crop for a year overnight. So I think a lot of people don't realize the pressure on such communities is one of the major reasons why poaching occurs. It is not because they are bad or greedy. Very often they are just hungry, desperate, and have very few alternatives. So anyway, over the years, ended up running forests and game sanctuaries, working usually as a reserve officer, either for police or parks and wildlife. And in about 2012, believe it or not, I got struck by lightning. This sounds like bad fiction, but it's very true. And it made me sit back and think after I'd recovered. It was a bad year, tough year, and I decided there and then, spoke to my wife and my kids, who were very small at the time, but I said, I need to get back to the grassroots. I've ended up running forests and doing all sorts of things, but I really want to get back on the ground with the rangers. And this was part of my recovery. It took me a long time to recover. I was badly hurt, injured, and it took me a couple of years to get over it. But I started training rangers voluntarily and guides. And usually what I found is I go into a park, and especially in Zimbabwe, and I'd find where I had known in the past game scouts and game rangers to be extremely skilled, experienced bushmen. Those skills were absent, shockingly absent. There was a massive gap. So things like tracking. You can't find someone in the bush with a drone. If you've got a huge national park and they know what they're doing, you're not going to pick them up. And you're certainly not going to cover all the national parks in Africa, vast areas, with such little resources. Such things can be useful. We use them tactically. But the reality is tracking is a skill that every game ranger needs to have, not only to pursue and follow someone, but to understand who's coming into an area, where they're coming in, where they're leaving, where they're moving, where they're crossing rivers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and when they're doing it. So you can start to understand where you need to be and when, and how to deter activity. So that was the next step. So I started doing that. I was also writing just to raise awareness, because I was getting a bit frustrated about what I was reading, you know, some of the solutions for conservation. Protected areas conservation, such as for anti-poaching specifically, like putting cameras in rhinos' horns, found particularly irritating. If your rangers haven't got boots, they haven't got a water bottle, and they don't know how to track, what is the point of putting a camera in a rhino's horn? All you're going to see is what it's eating most of the day. So these basic skills, which were hugely successful for decades, hundreds of years, maybe, we're being lost. And honestly, a lot of the problem of poaching is not that the skills and knowledge is not there. It's just that the problem has grown, has blown up into such a huge catastrophe that these parks and wildlife organizations have not been able to keep up in terms of training people. You know, they just do not have the resources. So I started writing about it, found I got a lot of support. And I also found, you know, what was missing was not just what I was teaching. It was all the other aspects of what a game ranger does, from investigations through to community engagement, human rights, you know, all of these important subjects were missing. And especially there was just no complete doctrine. So you went into a park. There were no standard operating procedures for anything from cleaning your weapon to driving through a riverbed. So I started bringing together volunteers and to develop, specifically develop doctrine for parks and wildlife departments, and to train the rangers and the leaders in that complete solution. And eventually we grew into an organization that now has specific sociocultural research and engagement domains, advanced analytics, tactical and security training, pursuit and interdiction, bushcraft, and a multitude of other expert individuals and skills in-house. And what we do is we go to parks and departments, always working with governments and NGOs, often, usually in partnership. And we work with the department to advance those skills and ensure that they are able to evolve or refine them as the situation develops or changes or as needed.
And as you were talking about earlier, is it that sympathy of communities struggling to make a living on the edge of wild areas that drove you to work in some of the most underdeveloped areas of Africa or the world?
Yes, I think it's a several reasons. One is, you know, there are environments where the wildlife and the communities are both at risk from the situation. I remember in 2013, I went into the Central African Republic, and I went into an area I probably shouldn't have gone into to find out what had happened to the parks and wildlife officers. And I found they were all gone, abandoned their posts or forced to flee. But the local community eco-guards, games volunteers, were using mostly captured weapons to protect the wildlife and the communities. You could call it a militia, and I'm sure, you know, this could go horribly wrong. It's not something you would want to put in place without good command and control. But this was enduring. So when everything else collapsed, complete anarchy, these people were, and they had a careful record of every animal that had ever been poached or shot, including some that had to. They said, we had to shoot certain animals to feed ourselves and the community. But this, here's the list. And these are the arrests we made. These are the weapons we've seized, all organized. It just carried on going. So those people need help. And the honest truth is, if you can't succeed, if you can succeed in these environments, you should be able to succeed everywhere else. I mean, it's the acid test. A place like Mali, you know, everyone just said, you're mad. Those animals are lost. You're going to fail going in there. And the same they've said a number of times for other environments, yeah, and they were wrong. Yeah.
So let's talk about Mali. And from the outside here in the UK, I think it'd be fair to assume that most people don't know a lot about Mali, except for what we occasionally hear on the news, whether it's a Al-Qaeda-backed separatist rebellion. But there's been recent turmoil. And what's it like on the ground? And what are the risks that you and your team face when you operate there?
Okay, so first, the rebellion was Tuareg, Tamashek, one of the group. The Al-Qaeda-backed or franchise on the ground, Jenin, as it's known locally, is also in conflict with the ISGS, the Islamic State, in the area. The ethnic groups, mostly the sedentary and versus the nomadic, are in conflict. And there's the ongoing political conflict, which has erupted into coups and so on. So the situation on the ground is, at times it feels like everyone's fighting everyone. The brutality is horrific, especially the massacres by some ethnic groups against others, and then reprisals, and it just descends into slaughter of entire villages. But amongst all of that, the reason there are still desert elephants there is because those communities, the same communities, have protected them. It's not no one got around to killing them. It's just they were actively protected for centuries. It's a relic population of uniquely desert-adapted elephants. And those elephants are also important for all of these different groups, political, religious, different ethnicities, in that they, every single group in Mali agrees that elephants are special. I've worked all my life, or I've lived all my life, in most of my life in Africa, and nearly all of that time in areas with elephants. And in many places, people see elephant wildlife as meat, and the biggest animal is the most meat. It's you don't find that special relationship. In Mali, it's very different, in that the Tamasheq people, for example, the Tuareg, see it as an elephant comes through their camp in the desert. It's a sign of good fortune, and it's a celebration. They drop whatever they're doing and they celebrate that the elephants are there. It's wonderful. The Dogon see elephants as sacred, as having human flesh, and that it's a total taboo. Killing an elephant is like killing a human being, and eating elephant meat would be like eating a human being. The Fulani are much more pragmatic about it all. They just say, you know, when the elephants come through, our livestock produces more milk, which is very likely true because they're knocking pods off the trees, which their goats and cattle can reach. So everyone sees elephants as special. And it is an umbrella species as well. If you're protecting elephants and their habitat, you're necessarily protecting all the other species that inhabit an area. So it's not only are you protecting the elephants, but you are reminding the people. I say remind because this is their culture. These are their beliefs. You're reminding them that they do have a common ideal. They have a common vision for their environment. All of the people in such an environment live closer to the environment than most people do in urban areas in the West. And it's a misconception that they somehow need teaching about the importance of environment. They intuitively, and often through harsh, hard experience, understand that better than all of us. So when we go into these areas and when we're working in them, we work with our partners, Wild Foundation in Mali, and they work with the communities specifically on assisting them, protecting their environment, educating their fellow people, and so on. And we focus on the law enforcement aspect. However, the rangers themselves are a key to reminding the population of the importance of the elephants. So when they go into a village or an area where the elephants may be, they provide medical assistance, up to 200 people a day, and they spend time explaining what their mission is and that they are not there to fight or to get involved in any fights. They are specifically there to help the local people, the communities, protect those elephants. This might, when you see pictures of footage of this unit, it looks more like Mad Max than game rangers because of the threat. Obviously, everyone from bandits to violent extremist groups see an opportunity either to display their dominance of an area or rejection of government, and attacks are inevitable. And there has been many attempts and many actual attacks on the unit, and it has to defend itself. But its name, its nickname in the area is l'Armée Gentille, which means the kind army. And that is because it's the rangers, and there's also soldiers in the unit, fully understand the importance of engaging with the communities, and that their mission is to protect them and the elephants. They do not see those communities as the enemy.
So the focus in this area is, of course, the elephants. Tell us what's special about these Mali elephants.
So they are a relic population of African bush elephants, effectively stranded in the middle of the Sahel, Sahara. And they have most likely over many thousands of years adapted to their environment. So they'll go up to 3 days at times without water, which is, if you know elephants, that's quite incredible. They also gone a long anti-clockwise migration through the desert, close to Timbuktu, and then down through Mopti, close to Mopti, and then down into Burkina Faso, and then they come back up again. So when the rains come, they go down into Burkina Faso because there's more food, and they can range more freely and get more nutrients and more variety of food that they need. And when it dries up, they go on this long trek through the desert, going from water point to water point and staying there until they've depleted the food, and then they move on. So they dwell in those places a week or 2 weeks, and then they move on from place to place. So they're quite incredible. I mean, they're for me, they were absolutely fascinating the first time I met them. I was dumbstruck. I've tracked so many elephants, approached so many elephants on foot, and they're always 100 times bigger when you're on foot close to them than if you're looking at them through binoculars or sitting in a vehicle or in a safe place. But these elephants truly are giants. I've never seen anything like it in my life. The first tracks I saw, I glanced at them and I thought, oh, that's a huge bull. Look at the size of that. And then I looked again and realized it was a female. So I was like, wow, that's like one of the biggest bull's tracks I've seen, and this is a female. They're also incredibly quiet, which I'm not used to with elephants. Every time I've watched them, they move along. You hear lots of goats, believe it or not, because they've got this huge entourage of goats who follow them around the desert, trying to pick up whatever they knock down from the trees. And cattle egrets, as they would in the wild elsewhere. But you hear all of that, but you don't hear the normal vocalizations that you hear with normal other African bush elephants or forest elephants. Not the very low frequency sound they make, or the flapping of the ears you hear, but you don't hear the usual knocking of tusks. And they're just like ghosts, giant ghosts moving through the desert. And it's truly amazing to watch elephants and camels in the same space on a sand dune. They don't like camels, by the way. They can't stand camels. They chase camels away.
And the great thing about this is, after all the hard work you've put in, you saw improvements and you saw the effect you were having in the Gorma region.
Yeah, the first year was extremely difficult. You know, the situation, the security situation deteriorated so rapidly. The poaching was so high, and the available equipment, skills, personnel, so depleted and sparse that it was touch and go whether we would be able to achieve anything. Finally, an agreement was signed between the Ministry of Environment and the military, whereby we could, the military provided troops to the unit to be retrained for these operations and kept specifically as in this combined unit, Parks Army unit. And the poaching went from 2015, 25% of the population of elephants killed, to 2016, 20% killed. And 2016, we started operationalizing towards the end of the year. And then 2017, the unit was fully operational and not one elephant was killed. So zero. In spite of that, the security situation, I mean, the attacks, the fighting, and the general breakdown of rule of law, escalated. So it was in completely the opposite direction to everything else. There have been elephants killed subsequently, but only one or two at a time every couple of years. So I think we've lost since that five elephants, which is a huge difference to 25% of the population. Very sadly, we've lost five men killed as well and many wounded. And of course, that we haven't lost a single man, touch wood, in operations. That's always been in camp, on downtime, or supposedly in a safe environment under protection of other personnel. In one incident, one of the team were killed, called out to support UN forces who were under attack. Yeah, it's all hands on deck. And a UN officer, Togolese officer, and our radio operator were killed, stepping up to help. It's people don't, we've recovered the same type of ammunition from elephant carcasses in this place that had been used to kill UN forces. And that shooting, killing UN forces is a war crime. So there's not just a link between the elephants poached and terrorism, but actual war crimes. So, you know, it's not this terrorists specifically targeting elephants. It's this badness is all mixed up. You have bandits, traffickers of children, women, people, drugs, weapons, as well as trading donkeys. It's unfortunately becoming more normal, and this is the tragedy.
And this is the term that is called convergence, am I right? This is
That's correct.
The idea that wildlife crime doesn't exist in a vacuum, that people are making money from wildlife trade will look to make money from drugs, weapons, trafficking, whatever else they can see a profit in, I suppose.
Exactly.
So if we move away from your work in the Sahara Sahel,
yes,
and we move across to Central African Republic, that's a completely different environment and a completely different set of problems that you're facing, isn't it?
Absolutely. So I think it was for 9 months, 2019, 2020, no forest elephants were found killed. So that's been very successful, our work in partnership with WWF there and with the government. But at the same time, pangolin and other bushmeat trafficking has escalated. And of course, pangolin is both bushmeat and high-value contraband, the scales. But the solution, both a lot of the problem and the solution lie with the communities in Central African Republic. They were, of course, devastated by the war. Cost of living, the availability of food and other products for a long time. And also now with COVID, that's also impacted them. And poaching of wildlife for food has escalated. But the solution in Tsanga Tsanga has been very much community engagement, sociocultural research and engagement. And we have a team led by Dr. Carolyn Joss Robinson, with Liz Hall, Robert Sambo, a Central African expert on the ground, working with the communities to understand really what is causing the need for poaching. And I'll give you an example. I mean, I'm not an expert in this. When I ask, and they are anthropologists, they sociologists, anthropologists, who all are truly invested in these communities. They all speak the language fluently, or they're from the community. And they work with the community leaders and the different villages. And, you know, I asked them, I said, well, you know, obviously if they need food, that's the problem. Someone needs to supply them with food. And I was told to stop talking. I'm talking nonsense, because that isn't the problem. There's actually a fair amount of money that people are working. They're being paid. And I'm talking, you know, for example, the Bayaka people normally would need to go into the forests to hunt. They would need to buy manioc in order to go and they hunter-gatherer peoples, called pygmies, which is not the correct term. But they would work in order to get the money to buy the manioc, go out and subsist in the areas where they're allowed to hunt traditionally. The problem is there's not enough meat for them to hunt traditionally because there's a lot of firearms hunting. You can solve that problem. But what they told me, that the team told me, is no, there's a lot of money moving around. But here's the problem. You work, you get money. What do you do with it? You've got nowhere to put it. There's no bank. There's no post office savings. You don't even have somewhere you can literally physically put it. It's going to get eaten by termites. So people buy food, booze, some drugs, and they consume that until it's finished, and then you go back to starving. So these people don't need someone handing out protein or food. They just need someone to help them manage their finances, be able to bank it. And, you know, I've just come back from Ethiopia, and I visited the Omo Valley, and it was fascinating to encounter the Mercy people, her cattle herders. And they have a similar problem. They have vast wealth in some ways in their cattle herds, in their estimation of what wealth is. And yet what happens is when there's a famine or a major problem, they're starving, they go and sell cattle, but they're all trying to sell it at the same time. The cattle are weakened. They're not in good health. So they get virtually nothing for the cattle, and, you know, they barely survive. that's a classic case of where those communities need support in fattening their cattle, selling them over a period of time, banking the money, and managing that those funds for lean times. So these people are not stupid. They're perfectly normal people, but in their environment, they know the cattle. They know how to survive in that environment. What they don't know is this modern system technology and how to work with it. And that's where they need just help.
So in those sort of environments, I suppose this is where your work with your partners comes in terms of introducing, whether it's technology, whether it's online banking systems, that's where you're looking to work with your partners, I suppose.
Absolutely. So what we do on the community side is first is try to understand the dynamics. What is happening in those communities that causes the poaching? What help can be provided to prevent that, whether it's education? I'll give you an example. In Guinea, 5 years ago in West Africa, in Guinea, I was training rangers in Oniger National Park. And we were talking about the particular area, and they said, no, it's the traditional hunters are poaching in the park. I said, but why? What do they say? I mean, if they're a group, then we need to convince them that this is wrong. There is an area where they're allowed to go and do their traditional hunting, but if they're going into the park with firearms, that's obviously poaching. So is this criminal, or is there some other reason? Are they starving? They said, no, they're not starving. Anyway, cut a long story short, we sat down with the elders, said, why are you shooting animals in the park? And they said, we're not. We said, first thing that goes through your mind, okay, now they're just denying it. So old chap said to me, where is the park? And I kid you not, the solution was that simple. Actually go and show everyone where the park is. Because it's just bush out there. No one had ever told them this is where the park starts and this is where your hunting area starts. So they were just all marching into the best hunting areas. I said, no one can tell us where this park is, and we've heard about it, but yeah, we don't know.
And yeah, it sounds like once you set up those fundamentals, you know, there's the ability for almost self-policing, and I don't know, the potential to put you out of a job in some of these places, I suppose.
If I'm put out of a job, then good. That's what we're trying to do. Absolutely. I don't think it's going to happen in a hurry, because the more we do, the more there seems to be needed to be done. I mean, altogether, we're working in something like the area of operations, add it all up, is something like 150,000 square kilometers and about 1,000 rangers, and that's ever increasing. But if we work ourselves out of a job, then I'm going to sleep the best sleep ever.
Then hats off to you. Yes. Yeah. And then in terms of a future, I suppose it's difficult to move away from the political environment in Mali, but in Zangasanga, increasingly we hear about ecotourism as a potential, because there's this bounty all around to see.
Yes. I mean, there is tourism. So Sanga Lodge has been operating throughout the conflicts and what have you. Incredible. Rod and Tamar Cassidy stuck it out throughout the Seleka takeover, the subsequent anti-Balaka rampage. And even now, they're still out there with the recent rebel movements. But yes, I mean, tourism can benefit, and sustainable forestry and other responsible programs utilizing resources in a non-consumptive or a sustainable way can benefit the protected area. But I disagree with those who say that wildlife must pay for itself. Some things should be paid for by all of us, including the air we breathe. And for our children, it's not about, you know, hunting is the only solution to wildlife conservation because it generates income. What nonsense. Every country on this planet at some point paid for the establishment and the protection of parks because of their national heritage and because it was the right thing to do and an important thing to do for the common good. It was not meant to be a money spinner. The very first national park, Gethsemane, if I remember correctly, was established by Teddy Roosevelt simply because it was spectacular and special. No other reason. We need to preserve this for future generations. But we've gone beyond just preserve it for future generations. If we want to keep our planet alive and our future as a species, then we need to protect biodiversity, and we need to protect the air we breathe, the food we eat, the waters we drink. And tying that to monetization only is nonsensical in my view. So some places deserve protecting. And when it comes down to it, when I look at what it costs us to turn around a situation like Zangezanga or Mali, honestly, it is chicken feed. It is peanuts. It is what some people will spend on a weekend party in some environments. I'm talking about celebrities, not the average average person like you or me. But when you hear about some of the extravagant, to me, I just find it disgusting. And I think about all the people making sacrifices, working so hard, and dying even. And then you look at that and you think, you know, what for? You know, why do you need a bloody great ship as for your private yacht with helicopters and all the rest? Yeah, it doesn't make any sense to me. But anyway, I've probably spent too much time in the bush to
understand it. I completely agree, but I'd never thought of it that way. Is why does something with inherent value have to be equated to financial value? So I suppose, Rory, that, you know, we're keeping here for long enough. But just a few things to finish up with. I've heard you talk online about your logo and the reasoning behind it. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about how your logo represents your work and your organization.
Sure, absolutely. So our logo is an elephant, and there's two reasons for that. One is elephants are an umbrella species. If you protect elephants, the idea is you have to protect their habitat and all the species that inhabit that habitat alongside the elephants. So that's a very good, important symbol for us. And the other one is elephants are a keystone species. They are critical to the survival of all the other species in the environments that they live in. So they, for example, forest elephants are the gardeners of the forest. They're the forest engineers. If you don't have elephants, you're not going to open up the forest for other animals to be able to move, and you're certainly not going to be able to germinate. I think it's 65% of the species of plants that need to pass through elephant systems to germinate. You can't do without them. So in a given environment, you take away the elephant, you change it. And I've been to parks where there are no more elephants, where elephants once were. And the entire carrying capacity for wildlife has plummeted. The biodiversity has changed, is gone. So for us, that's the reason an elephant is simple. We just love elephants. I mean, don't get me wrong. That's another reason, but it's an important symbol as well.
Fantastic. And it's been a pleasure to hear all about your pioneering work that you're doing. And I suppose, importantly, not to forget about the hardships that you and your team have been through, the sacrifice and the people who you're working with on the ground. To sort of commemorate that, what's been your proudest moment or proudest achievement working?
There's been many, many proud moments and many sad moments. I think the most important for all of us as a team is when there is a successful outcome. And by that, I mean, so for example, in Mali, I was told, you know, when I first went to Mali, these elephants are gone in 2 years. They will be extirpated, extinct. No more Sahelian desert elephants. The last of what were once hundreds of thousands, if not millions, gone. And for me to see those numbers, just to be able to see, I can look at an elephant and they are they're still there. The population is growing. The rangers are surviving. And the population are getting on with those rangers. So that situation, it's the same for going into Zangezanga. The elephant poaching is gone. The rangers are interacting happily and well with the community, and we're making ourselves obsolete.
Absolute privilege to have you here, Rory. We can all be so glad that there are people like you out there working in some of the harshest environments and most challenging places to save our natural world. So can you tell us where we can find you online and how people can help at home?
Yes, you can help by either donating directly to the organization, either in the United States or in Europe. We're online at chagetawildlife.org. But, you know, I understand that, you know, not everyone has money to donate, and I don't see that as the priority. The most important thing is letting other people know what it is we're doing, why we're doing it, and asking other people to spread the word. We're an organization that has not focused on publicity. We focus on getting the job done in the field. And sometimes I wonder if we shouldn't have someone just wandering around taking selfies with cute animals, but we're not. That's not what we do. And if anything, we're particularly bad at publicizing ourselves over the last few years, but we're getting better. But please, yeah, any sharing of our website, our social media pages would be most appreciated.
Brilliant. And I must say, when I was prepping this episode, finding out about the places that you're working, I was expecting to see and hear like confrontational and aggressive stories about working on the front lines in these environments. But hats off to you and your organization. You're certainly considerate more than militant. And just like your logo, it's great to see the all embracing and encompassing work that you do. So cheers for coming on, Rory. Cheers.
Thank you. Peace, love and happiness.